Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic magazine with the current offer of 5 issues for just £10. Head to our website, www.thecritic.co.uk, to subscribe today.
Graham and I are going to do a two-parter now on the situation in the universities today. And we're prompted in doing that by being well aware from reading items, from listening to people, from correspondence, that there is widespread concern about the situation, certainly in Britain and also in the United States. So I wonder if I could start off by making one or two general points. Graham, who is a true scholar, wanted me to start with the medieval ideal of the university, but I'm not sure that's necessarily terribly happy as a way to discuss the situation in 2024, when only a few dons in Oxford and Cambridge can remember the Middle Ages. But so what I wanted to first of all say is that when people in Britain, or indeed the United States, talk about the situation of the universities, what they actually mean in practical terms is in their own country, or at most in a slightly wider ambit. That does not necessarily address the question of the state of the universities today. It addresses the question of the state of the universities in those particular countries. If you were to adopt a global perspective, the general issue in the world to a sort of liberal, whether that liberal votes conservative, liberal, or Labour in Britain, is that in most of the world, universities are faced with authoritarian demands on the part of the state. Indeed, they're a branch of a corporatist state, which has a very clear-cut party-orientated political agenda. So you would see this in China, you would see this in Russia, you see it increasingly in many countries in the world. And indeed, that, as it were, should be one of the points of reference for the discussion in Britain or the United States, however different they are, because obviously one has to consider what these situations show us about the potential nature of the development. The second point about the universities, and here I am restricting myself simply to those countries about which I know, all of which are in the free world, is that there are obviously an enormous number of constituencies of interest and viewpoint. One might, if you wish, call them stakeholders. I prefer not to use that very ugly term. I think of a stakeholder as somebody who is about to kill some poor supposed witch or other person who's in difficulties. Or maybe a short order chef. But anyway, let's just say constituencies of interest. And one of the great problems in the nature of the debate is that these constituencies of interest are generally short-changed because people immediately start talking about what most interests them. So to give you an instance, and this is to admit a fault on home ground, although I wasn't responsible, The Critic recently had a number of articles on the universities which shamefully neglected the sciences, for example, and which were actually very parochial in their concerns. So let's start off by just giving you some of the constituencies of interest without in any way saying they exhaust the list or without in any way giving prioritization between them. We can discuss those. So among the constituencies of interest are the staff, the students, and we can separate the latter group very much between undergraduates and postgraduates, and much of the debate about universities tends to underplay postgraduates, which again is inadequate. We could look at the particular interests represented without necessarily holding them in any particular respect by whatever we mean by the management, which is the term often used for the supposed leadership. We can talk about the interests of government. We can talk about the interests of the taxpayer. We can talk about the interests of employers. We can talk about the interests of the parents and family of students and thus supporting them. We can talk about the interests of the geographical places where these universities are. We can talk about the intellectual nature of the debates in particular subjects, or indeed in subject areas as a whole, and discuss how far these are affected or reflected in debates within universities. And building on that, we could then subdivide just about everything we've said in terms of students, government, staff, employers, etc., by talking about contrasts and indeed, in some cases, similarities between particular groups of subjects and subjects, so that one's not just looking at them as intellectual entities, but one's also asking the question, how should you fund, or should you fund, in which case, how, shall we say, geology or German? And we can actually then obviously multiply that considerably. Now, once one reaches that kind of broad construction, we're in a much healthier but more difficult intellectual sphere than the rather glib and facile way in which most people debate it, which is to determine that their particular interest is supposedly the most important one and that their particular remedy is supposedly the most important one. That may or may not be the case in their view. It generally isn't very helpful. One also has to accept that there is the legacy of the past and the present situation. In other words, we might wish, if you think, to go back to some particular period in the time, in the past, which was supposedly a golden age, however defined, but we're actually in 2024. With the legacy of the decisions made, including in their very physical form, the buildings put up, and we have to discuss how we want to move forward from them. And the last point before I kick over to Graham is to say, if you have in any context, I mean, one of my fields is defense studies, and you can make the same point there about a multiplicity of constituencies involved, and a habit of glibly assuming that whatever suits oneself, let's say as one's a submariner or a tanker or whatever, is obviously what defines the subject. Inevitably, it's the case that you cannot assume, unless you're particularly stupid, that there is a perfect answer. What you have to assume is that depending upon how you place weight on these particular areas in the debate, that some will emerge, or some solutions, so-called, will emerge as more germane, more attractive than others, while accepting that other people will put a different weighting on. Maybe those people would actually be of a similar political or intellectual or cultural background as oneself, maybe not. But one shouldn't assume, for instance, if one is in Britain, that there is only one answer that is going to suit those people who are politically and intellectually either conservative or radical or whatever else you wish to spread on them, easy spreading's apparent ideology of the margarine quality of analysis. So that's where I want to leave us at the moment and push on to what Graham would like to throw back at me.
Well, thank you, Jeremy. My first thought is really to try and explore with you how a university should be. In Britain, there are obviously some universities which have a particular focus. Imperial College, obviously, is the sciences. And you know, MIT in the United States, similarly. But typically, universities cover a very broad range of subjects in both the sciences and the humanities. How unusual is that in a wider context? Is this very much a North American and British understanding of what a university should be? Or have we lost a sense of something which existed with the polytechnics before they were transformed into universities, mostly in the 1990s, where there were particular specialisms and sometimes specialisms which were tied to local industries and economies which were germane to where these institutions found themselves?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. I think the current fascination with a full spectrum has not necessarily been helpful. You did ask at one stage for us to discuss the medieval origins. Well, of course, as you're aware, in the medieval origins of universities, indeed, for a very long time, most of the subjects which now grace them and some of which caused derision, weren't there at all. And in practical terms, of course, universities were far more utilitarian bodies. I mean, it tends to be forgotten now by those who aren't particularly happy with utilitarianism as a guide to universities, but that the great subjects of the medieval and early modern periods were utilitarian. And that included, of course, anything to do with divinity or theology, because that was a key trainer for religion, which was obviously the clergy, an arm of society and the state. And it also included the law, which in many senses was the other major subject that had great utilitarian value other than medicine. So I think it's fair to say that it in relatively recently that one has had the embrace of a much greater range of subjects. I don't think it's particularly, one would say, necessarily improved the intellectual quality of degrees or of the life of universities, but obviously it fulfills what is seen now as more desirable. But you're absolutely right to ask, is it so desirable? And one can notice that subjects do come and go. There's been some interesting scholarly work on why geography went into a mid-20th century decline in the United States as a university subject, and in most universities has never recovered from that. You know, very much specific issues in specific Ivy League departments played a significant role in this. You had British universities founded in the 60s with a very varied subject mix. York, for example, did not have a large number of departments. That did not make it a bad university. And you could argue that many universities have spread themselves rather thin and that this has not been a good idea necessarily. The context is different in the United States to Britain, because in the United States, many staff, not all staff, but many staff have tenure, which means once you've hired them, it's more expensive to get rid of them, which means that you only really want to embrace a subject if you think it's going to last 30, 40 years. At the present moment in Britain and in recent decades, in theory, since tenure doesn't exist, it's actually easier to close down departments as well. You asked the point about the polytechnics becoming too wide-ranging. And of course, the key point here is that the polytechnics, which had a vocational character, rather like the technical universities or Hochschule in Germany and in Australia, those bodies tried to become full-service universities when they gained university degree awarding status. And obviously, that was in some parts completely ridiculous. So, you know, why on earth you should have, I mean, I'm a historian, why on earth you should have two departments of history in Newcastle because both Newcastle and Northumbria have them, or two in Sheffield because both Sheffield and Sheffield Hallam have them, and the same in Hull or Manchester. I think you're well entitled to ask. There is, of course, as you are aware, crude economics playing a role here. It is cheapest to teach the humanities. And what actually happens in most universities is there is a cross-subsidization, so that the university, and I can say this as a former member of the Finance Committee and also separately of Council, the governing body of the University of Exeter, and prior to that having been at Durham. The way it works is that you recruit very large numbers of people in subjects where you can recruit very large numbers, shall we say, law or history or English or in the sciences, psychology. from the, and those are relatively inexpensive to teach, and you then try and transfer funds from those departments to departments that are much more expensive to teach, of which engineering is a classic one. Or let me tell you of a joke I told the last Vice Chancellor of Exeter, who wasn't very pleased with it, but there you go. I told him this joke that the Vice Chancellor, not he himself, of course, as I made clear, the Vice Chancellor dies and goes to hell. And because he's an important entree, the devil himself comes to see him. And the Vice Chancellor says to devil, "Well, devil, what have you got to say to me?" And the devil said, "Well, sir, great honour to have you here, sir, man of your enormous importance, and we all admire your, you know, your writings on diversity and equality and such like." And the Vice Chancellor said, "Well, get on with it, man." And the devil said, "Well, you know, would you like to know anything about the facilities here?" And the Vice Chancellor says, "Yes." And the devil says, "Well, there are good things and bad things." And the Vice Chancellor says, "Well, what are the good things?" "Well, sir, the good things are you meet some very interesting people here, sir, and the women are quite wild." I don't think these days I'd get away with saying that, but you know what I've been. Anyway, these days I'm not sure we're going to be able to say that, to use the term women or men. But anyway, we'll leave that one side. Jokes should continue, even if they're dated. And you'll never be cold." And the Vice Chancellor said, "Well, that seems very reasonable, but you say there's a bad side as well." And the devil said, "Yes, sir, there is a bad side." "Well, what is it, devil? Get on with it." "Ah, well, I'm afraid, sir, you'll still be running a medical school." And that, because financially, I mean, medics are appalling people in universities. They will always say that whatever they want is absolutely crucial, or you'll be the equivalent of bayoneting babies at dawn. And they always want vast salaries, and they're always paid more money than anybody else, apart from the Vice Chancellor, if that's possible. And so that there are practical economics within a university as to why you would expand numbers in the arts when you might argue that there is more national economic utility provided by maintaining the vocational and science side. And that, I think, is a reasonable point. I mean, there are other ways of doing it. You might have a system in which you only funded those subjects and those institutions where you detected a strategic interest in keeping them going, STEM subjects, for example, science, technology, engineering, and maths, as well as medicine, as well as probably some modern languages, particularly minority modern languages, all of which you could make a case for. But could you imagine the fuss from the universities and from parents and from students if you said there was going to be no loans so they could do all sorts of subjects? Well, it's a political non-starter, isn't it? And that last point is a significant one, Graham, because while you and I could agree about much that is wrong with universities in terms of how they govern themselves, in terms of their staff, in terms of their ethos, in terms of often poor management, etc., etc., all of which is true, and we could happily take more than two programs on that, absolutely true. The point is, it's what is politically acceptable for change that is something that people need to consider. And it's all very well to say one ought to not do X or one ought to close Y. You know as well as I do that if you decided to close a university where there and therefore end up with a situation in which there is no university in that place, there would be, for a start, an enormous fuss from the MPs of that area, from the local government from that area, etc., etc., etc. So that it's all very well to talk about intellectual need or quality. There are many other elements that are part of the equation.
Well, we've had more than, what, a quarter of a century of university fees being levied in the United Kingdom. I want to pursue this line about, you know, following the money and where you're talking about arts degrees being cheaper. One of the arguments that was made 20, 30 years ago when introducing fees was being discussed was an assumption that once students had to pay for at least a portion of their tuition fees, they would start to think more about doing subjects which had greater economic and financial utility, at least to themselves. How much sign is there that market forces have actually really driven the direction of places for different subjects in STEM subjects and in the humanities in the last 20 or 25 years, with students making, albeit through loans they pay back later, making a contribution to their fees? Has it changed anything? Or really, are we looking at students still pursuing the subjects that happen to interest them or which they think they're good at?
Well, that's, again, an excellent question. One can see trends. How far trends are to do with particular explanations is a more complex one. So let me give you an example. It's generally agreed, both in Britain and in the United States, that the teaching of English literature as a university subject is in a crisis of falling numbers, falling applicants. Now, you could link that to the financial matter that you're talking about. You could also say it may be to do with the over-theoretical and, in some cases, intellectually bogus nature of much of what passes for the teaching of English literature in universities. So, you know, there can be more than one factor. I mean, these days, syllabi are open to scrutiny online. A student can see that many university courses in literature are matters for literary theory rather than an engagement with the excitement of text. So it's difficult to say. I mean, another tendency which is noticeable, and this may be linked to the changing gender composition of the student body, which is now much more strongly female than male. It may be linked to other sociological factors I could mention, but more students are going to universities that are closer to their homes than was the case 20, 30 years ago. And that again may be linked to costing. It may be linked to the desire to spend time living at home or living in the bigger family network or maintaining employment opportunities that one previously had. But of course, it may be other factors, uncertainty about different parts of the country or just simply wishing to keep going with a partner that one already has. These sort of things are very difficult to work out as to why a trend would happen. Your point about fees was an interesting one because it was also surmised that universities would offer very different fee structures. And in practical terms, the vast majority, the overwhelming majority, went for the maximum with no variation at all. You could debate whether that was or was not a mistake. It obviously contrasts with the situation for postgraduate degrees, both masters and doctorates, where there is considerable variation. But it does underline this point that many universities, as currently structured, and we can discuss whether a different form of structuring would be pertinent, but many universities as currently structured are struggling on the fee level, not least because it's not been rising with inflation, and inflation has gone up. And I mean, again, not just that I was on council and finance committee, and in fact also on Senate, I also had to write the institutional history. And I can remember, for example, looking at the documentation in the early 70s when inflation went up, particularly in energy costs, and that hit the university's finances very hard. So there are elements that arise from that. If you cannot cut your costs, and there are actually ways you could cut your costs, not least by dramatically severing the lessening the number of non-academic staff. But if, and which we can come to, we should come to, but if you don't want to cut your costs, then it's not surprising that they're also recruiting very significant numbers of foreign students, because those foreign students can be charged higher fees and can be used to cross-subsidize the domestic students or just to keep the finances going. And ironically, of course, since we are not in the European Union anymore, more students are classified as foreign students. So in theory, there are more people to recruit, though in practical terms, most recruitment is from China, India, Nigeria, rather than from, shall we say, France. So there's that element. I mentioned this business about saving costs. I mean, to me, it is remarkable that so many universities have as many or close to as many, or in some cases, more than half of their staff as people who are not doing teaching, but they may well be in HR, they may well be dealing with inclusion, they may well be dealing with all sorts of issues which do not necessarily contribute, in my view, to the principal purpose of the university. And there is also a very expensive cadre of administrators, some of whom are academics who lack, unfortunately, the dedication to either teach or do research, or maybe the ability to do that, but who seem to be able to pay each other bonuses and high salaries and retention awards and all the rest of it. And I suspect in years to come that people who, if they do write histories of universities, might say this was not appropriate and the councils of these universities were not exercising due scrutiny over the administrators. But, you know, obviously others may have different points of view on this.
Well, I'd like to pursue that line just a little bit further, because one of the things which has very noticeably changed in terms of the costs that universities have is, as you say, the increase of non-teaching staff, particularly administrators. I just want to unpick why this has happened. Should we say it's actually reflecting government policy? The more government sets up entities like the Office for Students and so on, that these set out guidelines, which it then requires a pool of administrators to interpret and roll out across campus. Should we see it as merely, you know, government keeps coming up with these initiatives and that therefore requires administrators to deal with it? Or should we also look at, you know, what's happened in the United States, where if anything, and of course we're speaking in general terms, but if anything, the march of the administrators has gone even further than it has in the UK. There are some universities where there are three times as many non-teaching staff as there are academics, which just seems completely out of whack. How is this march of the administrators? What's behind it, given that all it does is place costs on universities, which they then have to try and balance the books by other means?
Well, I think that's a very good question. I mean, there are one, or let's be clear, I'm fairly critical and I will continue to be critical. There are one or two advantages that one ought to mention. First of all, in a context in which, unfortunately, we're a more litigious age, it is necessary to check more things and to ensure that more things are standardized, and that does require time. And in some cases, there may well be, as it were, the taking over from teaching staff of jobs that possibly, in the modern litigious age, they are less well equipped for. So admissions is a classic one, because most admissions these days are done electronically and are not done face-to-face. We can discuss the attraction or lack of attraction of that, but that's just as is. But you're asking me why this happens. Well, first of all, the people that tend to recruit administrators are other administrators. They tend to run the universities. So it's not surprising that they will engorge with that. You know, it's in a way bolstering their own importance, isn't it? If you're going to demand a salary of 150k for running some branch of the university, you're going to need to show that you've got more than two employees in that branch of the university. So there are practical empire building. There's an intellectual sloppiness, which I think is very disappointing. I mean, if you look at many of the documentation put out for inclusion strategies or decolonizing syllabi, I mean, what strikes one, whether one agrees or disagrees with the goal, I personally don't, but other people do, but whether you agree or disagree with the goal, it's the sloppiness intellectually of it and the shallowness. And you have to say, what on earth are these people doing in a university if you imagine that a university is an aspect of intellectual life as opposed to a sort of part of a corporatist state for essentially lowest common denominators. But I think one of the difficulties is that the constituency, the political constituency within universities for teaching is rather weak. Now, you might have assumed that it should be stronger coming from the students. Individual students, of course, quite rightly get very upset by poor teaching. But the kind of student that gets to run student unions are political activists who are not particularly interested in the quality of teaching. Universities themselves have shown that they can be absolutely craven in dealing with industrial action, so-called, or inaction strikes by members of the union. It's not a closed shop. There's no need for the universities to heed the unions as they do, but they've chosen to do so. And I think it's, in a way, what one has got are very poorly run institutions which are incapable of using their resources adequately, and where the same sort of person who is a low-level administrator floats up, because that's how jobs are filled. You tick boxes as to what you've been on, what kind of particular courses you've attended. You're not going to get promoted for having a particularly profound view of on the teaching of French literature. You're going to get promoted because you've conformed yourself to a particular desideratum of the moment, and that desideratum then means that you go into the pool of those people whom the headhunters recruit in order to be deputy vice chancellors or provosts. That's a marvelous new post dreamt up a few years ago to essentially mean that vice chancellors didn't have to do as much work as they'd had to do hitherto and could slough off whatever they didn't like on somebody they could rely on to spout the rhetoric. All of this is expensive, but doesn't contribute to the quality of decision making. And I think that that is something that's very difficult. The key problem, though, Graham, is not analysing the situation at the moment. Most people who are informed know it's a complete shambles. The problem is, how can we move forward from here? And here you've got real difficulties, because given that, and I deliberately began with the situation at the global level, given that at the global level, authoritarianism is an area of considerable concern, do you actually want to increase the power of the state in higher education? And if so, in what spheres and how? Or if you wish to keep the power of the state at bay, how on earth are you going to deal with, shall we say, the more bizarre curiosities, which are not just occasional, but which are fairly central to the modern university, to wit, low-grade administration, which is also very expensive, Staff, many of whom are politically partisan to the nth degree, and quite a few of them are willing to go on strike despite any of their, and many of them aren't interested in teaching, and students whose political leadership is also baleful. I mean, how do you deal with that? And I'm not sure. I think maybe we should discuss that in our next discussion.
Well, I think that's probably a good place to pause, and in anticipation of that next of that next discussion. I mean, it does strike me that the better vice chancellors are paid, and some of them now have Premier League style football salaries. There's no obvious sign of better leadership. There's more administration, but not obviously better run universities. And I think picking up next time with, you know, is the role of government to intervene more or to intervene less? And if less, you know, are universities going to be better run or worse run for that is really where we should pick up next time. But for this introduction to the problems of the modern university, Professor Jeremy Black, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed listening to this podcast, why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered to your door? Subscribe today with the current offer of 5 issues for £10 by heading to our website www.thecritic.co.uk.